I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in the summer of 2011, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta said on a trip to Afghanistan, the U.S. is within reach of strategically defeating al-Qaeda. Back in the fall, while running for re-election, President Obama declared that al-Qaeda is on its heels. Last week, when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was testifying before Congress, she said the attack on the gas plant in Algeria and the political conflict in Mali, quote, were all part of a push by al-Qaeda to take advantage of political instability in northern Africa created by the Arab Spring. So, almost 2 years after the U.S. Special Forces killed Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad, Pakistan, who and what is al-Qaeda? We asked Daniel Byman to join us. He focuses on counterterrorism and Mideast security at the Brookings Institution. He's also a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program. He served as a staff member of the 9/11 Commission. His most recent book is A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. And Daniel Byman, it's been a number of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
You're welcome. Did the killing of Osama bin Laden do anything to weaken al-Qaeda?
Certainly. Bin Laden was an unusual leader. He was very charismatic. He was someone who could unify a movement that's historically been very fragmented. And he was a household name. So killing him was a tremendous blow to the organization. And what we've seen is that the core, the movement in Pakistan that now is led by bin Laden's successor, Ayman al-Zawahiri, that core is much weakened. And while it's still somewhat of a danger, it's less dangerous than it was, say, 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
There were documents taken from that raid on Abbottabad. Does anyone know, has anyone looked at those documents, and has it revealed anything about al-Qaeda?
The United States took hundreds of documents from that raid, and U.S. intelligence has pored over these. Only a few have come up publicly, so we have to be careful about what we conclude because we've only seen a little bit publicly. But what they show is that the organization was in trouble in a variety of ways. It spent a lot of time worrying about various al-Qaeda members who had been captured. It was concerned about the constant drone campaign that was decimating its members in Pakistan. And also we have these different affiliate organizations like al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula or al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb. And the documents showed that the core organization, bin Laden, his advisors, were very worried about these local organizations and feared they might do damage to the al-Qaeda brand and the al-Qaeda message.
And I do want to talk about some of those affiliates. You said in an article that you wrote about al-Qaeda is to think of it today as a set of circles. Draw those circles for us.
In the center of the circle, you have Ayman al-Zawahiri and the core organization in Pakistan. This circle is relatively small. It's probably a few hundred individuals. They're very skilled. They're very dedicated. And part of what they want to do is lead a global movement. When you get outside that core area, you get the individuals who have been trained by al-Qaeda, who are, again, quite skilled, and who have spent time in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Iraq working with al-Qaeda figures. And they share al-Qaeda's worldview, but they're involved more locally. And this circle is linked in many ways to these affiliate organizations, groups that have a local agenda but also have embraced part or all of the al-Qaeda core's global agenda.
And looking at that core, do they give orders and do the affiliates take orders from that core?
Yes and no. The core does give orders, and we have seen affiliate groups obey these orders, and these orders range from guidance about when to declare an Islamic State to calls for targeting more U.S. and more Western targets. So certainly they obey them, but not completely. Most of these local groups still primarily concentrate on local objectives, and at times they disregard the core's orders. At times they feel they're unable to carry them out. So we see a back and forth between the local groups and the core where it's neither black nor white. There's a lot of gray in between.
And is al-Qaeda directly training members that affiliate themselves with these groups?
Al-Qaeda historically has trained a lot of these affiliates. So we've seen people go in the past to Afghanistan and then to places like Iraq and Pakistan where they receive training in al-Qaeda camps or camps with ties to al-Qaeda and then go back to their local home countries. And there they were much more dangerous, they were more skilled, but they also shared the al-Qaeda core's ideology. Because of the drone campaign and because of broader efforts in Afghanistan, Pakistan, the scale of that training has been reduced. We still see individuals going back and forth, but fewer of them. So this is a problem, and a lot of the historic leaders and even current leaders did have these personal connections and this training, but this is something that effective counterterrorism has reduced.
And does Al-Qaeda have money, and do they spend money to support some of these groups?
Al-Qaeda historically has used its money to buy influence. So it supports these groups with weapons, by training their people, by providing propaganda. But the broader financial effort against Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda mistakes, lots of problems have led Al-Qaeda to lose money. Hmm. So its ability to use its financial pull is much less. Some of the affiliates historically have been very poor and have really depended on kind of local means to sustain themselves and maybe gotten a bit from the Al-Qaeda core. A few have actually had their considerable money, especially Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So again, it's a very mixed picture, but I would say that the financial situation for the Al-Qaeda core has suffered in recent years.
But where do they get their money for those that do?
There are a variety of sources. One source for Al-Qaeda's money are donations from wealthy sympathizers, especially in the states of the Arabian Gulf, so Saudi Arabia, Qatar, states in that region, where there's some sympathy, and part for Al-Qaeda and part for related causes. And the budgets aren't huge, so donations that are in the tens, hundreds of thousands or more can really go a long way for these organizations. For the more local ones, they'll depend on local sources. So what we see recently in the Maghreb, or not so recently, what we've seen in the Maghreb for a while is kidnapping is very important. They kidnap, they demand ransoms, and they get a lot of money that way. Some groups have been involved in smuggling. Others try to effectively tax the local populations that they work with. And so we see them using a variety of sources for fundraising, both top-down and bottom-up.
When you look at this core center of Al-Qaeda, do they still want to attack the United States, destroy the United States? Is that still a stated goal?
Absolutely. The core organization is very committed to going after the United States, and they've tried to push the affiliate organizations to do so as well. They've had only mixed success, though, on the affiliate organizations. Some, like Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, have tried several times to down U.S. aircraft. But others have focused really on going after U.S. or Western targets in their area. So in Algeria, just most recently, of course, we saw an Al-Qaeda affiliate that has gone after what it considered a Western target, the staff at oil facilities. But it did so in Algeria itself. So it was a mix of the local and a more global perspective.
Do you agree with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when she said that looking at what happened in Algeria and even what's happening in Mali, that that's Al-Qaeda taking advantage of political instability in northern Africa created by the Arab Spring?
I would say that's true to a degree. Al-Qaeda always seeks opportunities. So if there is a civil war in Syria, if there is unrest in Libya, if there is a coup in Mali, it will try to take advantage of that. But if you look at Mali, this is a country that historically has been almost always been very weak. So some of it's linked to the Arab Spring, some of it's linked to Al-Qaeda opportunism, and some of it is just events on the ground by local fighters that has been kind of caught up in this broader struggle.
In fact, looking at Mali, you've got then some jihadi groups with loose or maybe not so loose connections to Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AGIM. How long has AGIM been around?
The Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is a group that kind of sprang out of the Algerian civil war in the 1990s. And it became a formal Al-Qaeda affiliate about 5 years ago, but the organization that preceded it had been moving in that direction for several years as well. So this was really an evolutionary process where you had a local group with a local agenda in the 1990s gradually become more global and then eventually take on the Al-Qaeda label. But even when it did so, it still retained some of its local agenda. So this has been, rather than a shift from local to Al-Qaeda in either extreme, it's more been a relative sense of which target should we go after, and a group that has gradually become more global.
Well, as we know, the French are in there fighting, AGIM, but also some of the reports out of northern Mali about amputations and about a kind of sadism that has been perpetrated on the people living in that country.
Absolutely. And this is something that Al-Qaeda is part of a broader movement, many of whose adherents believe in an extremely strict and puritanical interpretation of Islam, and they call for draconian punishments. The equivalent in, say, modern Christianity or Judaism would be if we stoned adulterers, which is what the Bible talks about. So using those types of punishments, and as soon as they come in, they have been implementing this, and not surprisingly, this angers and alienates and horrifies much of the local population. So in many ways, these local groups are their own worst enemy, where they'll come in and maybe the people there don't like the government so much, but when these groups come in, they realize just how horrible they are. And what we saw in Mali is the French, who, because of colonial reasons, have historically been suspect and disliked by many Malians. When the French have come in, people are waving French flags and delighted to see them, and that's in large part because of how brutal these groups have been.
Is reign of terror too strong a phrase?
No, it's not. And for what we saw in Mali is, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people fleeing these groups because of how horrible they are. And these are poor people for whom leaving their homes means leaving everything. So for them to do that shows really how brutal these groups are.
Would it be fair to say that Muslims are under a greater threat from Al-Qaeda than Americans?
Oh, certainly. I mean, these groups are active in the Muslim world. That's where they fight. Those are the governments they oppose. So much of this is a struggle within the broader Islamic movement, and then it's a struggle between these jihadist groups and their governments. So the United States is part of this, but in terms of the actual body counts, it's far worse for Muslims of all sorts than it is for Westerners.
But looking at Mali, and things are very much in flux even as we speak, what does AQIM, what do they want?
AQIM wants to expand its operations in order to effectively govern part of the area and have a base, and from that base, first of all, be able to implement its vision of Islam, so this draconian version we talked about. It also wants to be able to have freedom of operation so it can train its fighters, so it can conduct broader attacks throughout the region. So it's using the unrest and using its ability to exploit it to try to create a new safe haven. And in so doing, it's fighting its enemies. It sees local governments, it sees the French, it sees the United States as foes. And so these are opportunities to fight as well as opportunities to govern.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Daniel Byman is our guest today in Radio Times. We asked him to join us to talk about what Al-Qaeda is and perhaps even what it isn't, the ongoing threat of Al-Qaeda. And he focuses on counterterrorism and Mideast security at the Brookings Institution. He's also professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program. And he was a staff member of the 9/11 Commission. Any questions or comments, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Montgomery School, an independent co-ed day school for pre-K through 8th grade, supports WHYY. Montgomery School believes that when children find joy in learning, they are forever inspired to explore their world and are best prepared to succeed in their educational pursuits and beyond. An open house and winter carnival will be held on their 60-acre Chester Springs campus on Saturday, February 2nd at 10:30 a.m. Full details can be found at montgomeryschool.org.
The WHYY Winter Membership Campaign starts this week. With the WHYY Buyback Program building momentum, we could shorten the drive. For every 750 donations we receive, we'll eliminate a full day of on-air pledging. That's less on-air pitching and more news and information. But we need to hear from you right now to make it happen. Make your donation at whyy.org/support.
Next time in Studio 360, Sue Grafton began her series of mystery novels with A is for Alibi, and she's been working her way through the alphabet, 22 down, W, X, Y, and Z to go.
I am hoping that by the time I write X, Somebody will invent an entirely new crime.
Novelist Sue Grafton, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Daniel Byman about the evolution of Al-Qaeda, the threat that Al-Qaeda poses to the U.S. and to other countries, and what can be done to limit and confine its influence. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Daniel Byman, looking then at Mali, we were just talking about Mali. From your perspective, how do you defeat Al-Qaeda in a country like Mali?
Well, I don't like to use the word defeat because I'm not sure we can come to such a decisive conclusion. I would say setback or limit. To me, you do several things. Part of it is that what the French are doing now, which is they're using their own forces, working with locals to try to drive the local Al-Qaeda-linked individuals, drive them away from populated areas, to really marginalize them and put them in the deserts and the caves on the edge of Malian society. At the same time, it's a regional strategy. You're working with Mali's neighbors, whether in Niger or Algeria, to make sure that things don't spread and that these fighters don't simply go from one country to another, as we've seen them do again and again. And last, and probably most important, you're working with the government of Mali. You're trying to build up its military capabilities, but you're also trying to build up its legitimacy, its ability to deliver for its citizens. And that combination over time will shrink the space in which the radicals can operate. At the same time, it will make the citizens of Mali more willing to cooperate with their own government and make their own government more effective, because in the end, foreign forces, whether French or American or regional, can only do so much. It's going to come down to the actual government in question, and that's where the long-term focus should be.
Do you think the U.S. should be more directly, more overtly involved in Mali?
My personal view is no. I think that what we have in Mali are a number of groups that have some limited ties to Al-Qaeda, and we have a close and very capable ally, France, that's effectively taking the lead. And there's no reason for the United States to add its resources to this when I think they're needed elsewhere, and we've already have a pretty heavy burden. However, the United States should be doing what it can to help the French with intelligence, with surveillance, with strategic lift, in order to make the French forces more effective, as well as helping the French coordinate a regional strategy. So I think the idea of having a good ally take the lead is the right place right now.
The New York Times reported that the Pentagon is planning on installing a drone base in Niger, not too far from Mali. The idea of using that as a launching pad for surveillance flights over Mali. Do you favor that?
Certainly. To me, part of the goal is to have a much greater intelligence knowledge of the area. That way, should the United States decide to escalate, it will be able to do so in an intelligent way that uses force in a careful way, in a way that's the most effective. The intelligence can also be shared with the French, with the local governments, to make them more effective. So to me, having these small bases that help gather intelligence is a very prudent step right now.
Because it's so difficult to get intelligence on the ground?
It's difficult to get intelligence on the ground, and it's time-consuming. That you are literally gathering thousands and thousands of bits of information and trying to piece them together. You're trying to find out which sources are accurate. You're trying to figure out new ways to communicate this information to allies. All this is very hard. All of this is very time-consuming. And you're going to make a lot of mistakes. So you want to get these processes up and running early so you can work out the problems in case you need to become more aggressive later.
But don't you need human intelligence in dealing with these groups?
Absolutely. And the human intelligence might come from the Mali government, which has its own sources on the ground. It might come from the French. It might come from U.S. efforts. So there are a lot of different ways to get human intelligence. And then you mix it with the imagery. You also get communications information that's intercepted. So it's not just human intelligence. It's a range of different intelligence sources that are combined. And when it's done right, they start to feed on each other in a very productive way. So imagery might detect that in one part of Mali there seems to be a lot of activity, but you don't know exactly what it is. Well, that might lead to a phone call that leads the Malian government to send a spy there. It might lead to more targeted efforts to intercept phone communications. And together, these different pieces of information can help us put together the puzzle.
We've been talking about Mali and the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. They apparently reportedly were involved in the attack on the oil refinery compound in Algeria. So do you see this as part of a planned attack on either local governments or local resources?
Certainly the attack in Algeria was a strike against both the Algerian government and against Western interest. We've seen these Algerian groups take hostages. That's kind of part of their modus operandi. And Western hostages are particularly valuable for them, both because they can get a greater ransom and because they attract much more attention. Going after the oil sector is something that is a vulnerable point for the Algerian government, mm-hmm. and because so much of their revenue depends on oil. And it's one that historically the radical groups in Algeria have had less success going after. So this is something they saw, I think, as a multiple victory if they could pull it off. And the Algerian government's very tough, at times very brutal response was a mixed blessing for the groups. It called a lot of attention to their cause, but at the same time, they were not able to drag this out to have an extensive hostage mm-hmm. negotiation that would get even more attention, to get tens of millions of dollars in ransom. So from their point of view, they succeeded in some ways, but they also failed in others because of the Algerian government's response.
And succeeded in that sort of PR way, public relations way?
Absolutely, and this is something that's very difficult for the United States to counter. These groups use the media to fight. In many ways more effectively than they use bullets. They're trying to convey an image of bravery, an image of defiance, an image that they and they alone are the ones standing up to Western oppression. And they do that through these high-profile, spectacular attacks that generate a lot of media attention. And these are things they use to draw recruits, to gain money, and is one of their most effective methods.
I'll try this out on you because I've tried it out on other people that we've had on the show to talk about Al-Qaeda. Some have said, think of it like organized crime and in a sense, treat it like a bunch of mobsters. Does that fit your scenario, your vision of Al-Qaeda?
Yes and no. I would say there are crime similarities in that part of what they do is financial. In the Maghreb, they smuggle cigarettes. In the Maghreb, they hold people for ransom. These are criminal activities, and these are things that are they use to sustain their organizations. They also flourish because the state is weak. So just like the mafia flourished in immigrant neighborhoods where there wasn't much of a police presence, where people didn't trust the government, you have that in these countries where people don't expect the government to help them, so they turn to local warlords or local militias or terrorist groups, really to kind of play that role and to enforce order, because they would prefer even a draconian set of laws to no laws at all. But there's a big difference in my view, and that difference is about politics. Unlike the mafia, these groups have a political agenda. They want to change dramatically their societies. They want to change dramatically their governments. And that's part of the image they sell. They're not simply trying to get young people to join and get support from around the world because they're making money. They're trying to get people to join because they have a cause. So a lot of what the United States should be invested in and has tried to do is to try to discredit that cause, to try to show its flaws, to try to show its brutality. And so to me, that's quite different from organized crime.
And what's the appeal of what they're selling?
For many young people in the Muslim world, they look and rather than see kind of the U.S. image of the United States trying to help area governments, they see the United States as a force of oppression, that the United States invaded Iraq and killed large numbers of Muslims there. U.S. strikes in Afghanistan have killed many civilians there. That the United States-backed governments like Mubarak in Egypt, like the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia, that are repressive. And so they see the United States as a power that's really bent on dominating the Muslim world and being hostile to Islam. And as a result, there's a certain Robin Hood quality that Al-Qaeda has tried to cultivate, where they're maybe weak, but they're standing up and they're fighting back, and that's something that has a lot of cachet in some, not huge, but some circles.
And that's Daniel Byman, professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program. His work is focused on counterterrorism and media security at the Brookings Institution. He was also a staff member of the 9/11 Commission, joining us in this hour of Radio Times today, talking about what is Al-Qaeda today, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Daniel Byman, let me get a couple of callers on. We have, looks like Mort from Levittown joining us on Radio Times. And go ahead, you're on the air, Mort.
Yeah, I just want to mention one thing. Targeting Osama bin Laden was a successful targeted assassination. How come we're not using it everywhere? Either using it like we did it to Osama bin Laden, do it through drones. After a while, it would become non-profitable for them to be Al-Qaeda members.
Well, Mort, let me give Daniel Byman a chance to respond to that. And we have targeted and killed others who are affiliated, associated with Al-Qaeda. Daniel Byman?
That's right. The drone campaign against Al-Qaeda has been remarkably aggressive. This is something that was quite limited under President Bush, but really took off under President Obama, where we saw the strikes go from just a few to around 100 in 2010 in Pakistan. We saw strikes expand to Yemen, to Somalia, to elsewhere. So the idea of killing terrorists is something that is seen as relatively non-controversial in Obama administration circles. And I think it's going to be part of the U.S. counterterrorism arsenal for a long time to come. So when we talk about setting up a base in Niger with regard to what's happening in Mali, what some people think is this may be a prelude to eventually not just doing surveillance, but doing armed drone strikes in that region as well.
But we also know drone strikes have killed civilians. There are people apparently living under the sound of drones that frankly don't appreciate the U.S. Surveilling them.
Absolutely. And this is something that in some parts of Pakistan and Yemen in particular have caused problems. And they cause problems in two ways. One, of course, is the deaths of innocents, which not only is tragic in of itself, but angers the locals involved. But the other is that it shows that the governments in question are not capable of resolving these problems by themselves, that it's something that's humiliating for the governments in question, and even though they work directly with the United States, it damages their credibility in the eyes of their own people because they are not able to stop a terrorism problem or they are not able to secure their own people. As a result, the United States uses drones, but it creates a political dynamic in the countries in question that, to me, can at times backfire.
Well, and it seems there are also concerns in this country, and perhaps these are critics of the Obama administration's use of drones, which is that it's done, we haven't really had a conversation in this country about our drone program, and it's apparently signed off by the president directly. I think you could see that as a positive or a negative, but it's a strategy that's largely secret.
That's correct. We've seen change in the last year where a number of very senior officials, including the Attorney General, have started to lay out a framework for when drones would be used and when they would not be used. Mm-hmm. And I think Obama administration officials themselves are concerned that this instrument be, I'll say regulated, that's probably the wrong term, but be controlled in a legal framework to some degree because they want to make sure future administrations use it responsibly as well. But this is something that doesn't excite much debate among the American people in general. I think there are people in the civil liberties community who are concerned, but I would say that the vast majority of Republicans and most Democrats appear to support this instrument. So it hasn't generated mass debate. Mm-hmm. And in my view, that's a shame. I'm a proponent of using drone strikes, but I believe they have drawbacks, they have limits, there are times they shouldn't be used, and we should have a fairly robust discussion of all these things.
Well, I would like to host that discussion on Radio Times. Let me get Tommy from Downingtown to join our conversation. And Tommy, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I want to be in on that discussion now and when you talk about it in the future. I'm a little concerned about the professors embracing the use of drones so readily. My apprehension is just where are the lines being drawn? Are we going to be using drones anywhere where we think that there's a target that we want to get, or are we going to be using drones against countries with whom we are at war? I know, you know, we're not at war much these days, but still, you know, there are concerned citizens about the use of military use of drones and the otherwise use of drones. And I think that discussion, you know, needs to be brought out. That's a comment. I object to the Obama administration. I'm a big supporter of President Obama, but not in this respect.
I hear you.
It's funny that the Bush administration, you know, shied away from using that, the drones, and then Obama just went full speed ahead with them.
Well, Tommy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Daniel Byman, your thoughts?
I agree with the caller that we should have a broader discussion on this. Let me say, though, I'm a bit less concerned, I think, that this will end up being a weapon used everywhere, because from a counterterrorism point of view, you almost always want to arrest terrorists rather than kill them. And that's not because of a human rights concern of arresting is better than killing them, but rather, if you arrest them, you can gather information, you can interrogate them, you can ask them questions and learn about the next plot. And if you kill someone, you can't do that. So in the vast majority of countries around the world, U.S. counterterrorism is done by calling up the police or intelligence service of the countries in question and having them try to arrest the person or gather information on them. It's only in countries like Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia where the government is seen as unwilling or unable to arrest that the United States uses drones. And so it's a relatively small set of countries where drones would be preferred, because in other countries we'd rather use arrest. So I think the set of possible countries is limited. But again, to go back to the caller's point, even within that set, there are a lot of questions about when you do these attacks, who should be responsible, what the criteria are for risks to noncombatants. And I think we should have a much broader debate on that.
And I would assume even complicating that is that we're not necessarily in a declared war against these countries. We're fighting these jihadist groups or these affiliates of Al-Qaeda, or even Al-Qaeda itself.
I would say not only that, but we're fighting them often in conjunction with the countries where the groups are active. So we're working with the Pakistani government or the Yemeni government or the Malian government against these groups. So our drones, in some ways, are acting in part as their air forces. Hmm. We're doing things their governments cannot do. And often publicly they will criticize these drone strikes, but we've had repeated press accounts that a number of these countries have been active in coordinating these drone strikes behind the scenes. So we see these groups, these countries as, I would say, complicit, but I'd go even further, which is supportive. And in some ways, countries like Iran, where we're hostile, the United States does not use drone strikes. There's an Al-Qaeda presence in Iran, but the United States is not using drones there because, I believe at least, it has the risk of escalating to a much bigger conflict. So the United States uses it with countries where it, at least to some degree, has some sense of alliance, but not as of yet in countries that are declared enemies.
And that's Daniel Byman, our guest today on Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking about what Al-Qaeda is today. And he is a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program, also works at the Brookings Institution. He was a staff member of the 9/11 Commission. His most recent book is A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Zollner Arts Center at Lehigh University supports WHYY. Zollner Arts Center presents Mountain Heart this Friday, March 1st at 8 p.m. for one show only. Mountain Heart combines bluegrass with rock, country, blues, and jazz, and brings their own style of excitement and energy to live performances. Tickets and more information are available at 610-7LU Arts or online at zollnerartscenter.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how the U.S. military came to embrace counterinsurgency as an approach to the fighting in Iraq and why it's failed in Afghanistan. We'll talk with journalist and historian Fred Kaplan, author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What direction will Egypt take? Violent protests, a new president who's imposed curfews and a state of emergency, much like the old president did. Also, why are people paying to crawl through mud and live wires? We'll look at the world of Tough Mudder, Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Daniel Byman about Al-Qaeda. Almost 2 years after the U.S. killed Osama bin Laden, it does look like Al-Qaeda is still alive and well. There are affiliate groups that have sprung up in the Middle East and in Africa. Some have vowed to strike Western targets while others are engaged in local power struggles. That's what we're talking about today on Radio Times and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Pete from Philadelphia to join us. Pete, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was surprised to hear Mr. Byman describe Al-Qaeda in this kind of concentric circles with the core, when in much of the counterterrorism literature and security studies literature seems to describe them as a network. And so my question is kind of shifting the focus to kind of homegrown terrorism. Because this idea of the network has been used to link Americans who want to take up arms against America to Al-Qaeda and to this core. And if you reading the literature, it's very the definition of network is very sloppy and it's equivocal.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't really a clear idea of what it is. So my question for Mr. Byman is relatively simple. From a security studies standpoint, does he see a need for more precision in these definitions to kind of avoid what some people have called practices of entrapment? Or does he see it necessary to kind of have these broader definitions which can encompass many more activities and ideas?
Pete, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Daniel Byman, is it important what we call Al-Qaeda?
It is important what labels we use. Now, you can think of these labels, terms like network or concentric circles, in very precise definitional terms that I might use when writing a scholarly article, or as metaphors. And at times people will mix the two. And I think when we think of Al-Qaeda as images, I think the problem is it doesn't neatly fit any organizational model. It historically has had elements of a traditional hierarchy with a leadership structure, subcommittees, and people who report to them, and a very top-down structure. And major attacks like the 9/11 attacks were top-down. At the same time, and even simultaneously, it's had a structure that's much more like a network, where individual cells are given tremendous autonomy. They often communicate with one another rather than going up the chain and down the chain. And so what makes this organization very difficult and at times very dangerous is that it's able to use multiple organizational structures, and these shift. So when we hit the core leadership hard, when we hit the top hard, it becomes more networked. When that's eased up on, it tries to become more hierarchical. So we do see multiple organizational structures, and when we combat this organization, we have to recognize its ability to shift.
Do you think there will be an attack on the United States? And I don't mean that as an overly dramatic question.
I will say there will certainly be attempts. This group has tried to attack the United States in a variety of ways. Since 9/11, you could argue something like the Fort Hood shooting was a success, but on the scale of what people were concerned about, say on September 12, 2001, this seems like it's been a very good, a very good 11 years. But we did have a couple near misses. There were two airplanes that really came, within a hair's breadth of being downed because of Al-Qaeda link attacks. And I think if those had succeeded, we would look at the last decade very differently. So I think Al-Qaeda is going to keep trying, but it's harder. The organization's leadership is under siege. There is a global campaign against it. And their ability to do kind of long-term planning that's required for sophisticated attacks to me is diminished. So I don't want to say it's impossible for them to do it. I don't want to doomsay, but I'll say they'll try, but their ability to do these high-profile spectaculars is reduced.
I mean, some have said even the terrorists that have tried to attack the United States are just more incompetent than the ones that did successfully on September 11th.
There's no question about that. If you look at the track record of many of the Americans who have been arrested for attacks or convicted, incompetence is probably the dominant feature. Mm-hmm. And the key here, though, is that many of these individuals were actually quite smart. They just weren't trained. And so if you look at the 9/11 hijackers, and especially the four masterminds, or four leaders, these were people who were well-trained, who had spent time in Afghanistan, who had these linkages to the core. And that's part of what made them more dangerous. So part of the U.S. success in the last decade has been trying to reduce or sever these linkages between people who might be radicalized at home and their ability to get training and become more lethal abroad. And so I would say that many of the homegrown people, you know, if we look at, you know, horrors like the various school shootings, we know that it doesn't take much for someone to pick up a gun and kill people. But in terms of doing a higher profile attack that's going to kill a lot more people, exponentially more, that's much harder and usually requires some training.
Pete, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. I'm talking with Daniel Byman about Al-Qaeda and terrorism. Let me quote something in today's paper from the Associated Press. This is about Syria. An Al-Qaeda-linked group fighting alongside Syrian rebels claimed responsibility Monday for a suicide car bombing that reportedly killed dozens of President Bashar al-Assad's loyalists last week. So help us understand perhaps the relationship between then Syrian rebels and al-Qaeda-linked fighting groups that are apparently fighting alongside these rebels. How do we differentiate who's fighting for what cause?
Syria has become perhaps the most important theater for al-Qaeda today outside of the Afghan-Pakistan area. The Syrian conflict has seized the imagination and the sympathy of much of the Arab world. And this is often how al-Qaeda is able to gain entry into local areas, where it comes in and says, your government is brutal, your government is oppressive, the world is doing nothing, and we're here to help. And as a result, they gain a toehold that later on becomes a foothold and later on becomes a much greater presence. So if you look at the history of this conflict, it begins as peaceful resistance. Then there's limited armed resistance, but really no al-Qaeda presence. Then, months later, we get a report of a few fighters here and there. Then we get to, well, a small organized presence. And now we get to, well, they're a serious part of the opposition. And this is very difficult because from the opposition's point of view, much of the world is ignoring them. And here you have fighters who are effective, who are dedicated, who are willing to die on their behalf. So it's hard for them to say, no, we're not going to work with these people when the opposition doesn't have an alternative. And so this has been an al-Qaeda success. And it's very hard from a U.S. point of view because there is a danger of a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is we're concerned about an al-Qaeda presence and that if we aid these opposition groups, we're aiding al-Qaeda. But by not aiding them, we're giving al-Qaeda-linked groups a greater window in which to go through and trying to insert themselves into the conflict.
So what do you think the United States should do?
My personal view is that the United States should be more aggressive in backing the Syrian opposition. And this would be a broader program to work with allies, to arm them, to train them, to give them an alternative to al-Qaeda, and also make them more effective, both in terms of defeating the regime's forces, but also in terms of the aftermath. We need a unified opposition. If they're fighting amongst themselves, if they're incompetent, then Syria is going to be a failed state in the future, even if Bashar al-Assad falls quite soon. And the United States programs need to recognize that.
But is it possible to help the rebels without helping al-Qaeda?
When you are putting arms into an area, you have to accept that some of the arms are going to be lost and they're going to go into the wrong hands. And that would be tragic and that would be horrible, but that's just a reality of the situation. It's chaotic there, and there's a lot of back and forth among these groups. And to assume that the United States would have control over everything would be grossly unrealistic. The bigger thing to me, though, is not arms, but training. Mm. It's helping these groups learn how to fight. And here, the United States, part of why the al-Qaeda-linked groups are popular is that they are effective. And what we want, though, is to give young Syrians who are opposed to their regime an alternative to say, okay, if you want to fight, if you want to join an effective group, there's a better group out there than these jihadists. And that group might be one that's actually more friendly to the United States or at least less hostile.
Let me ask you about Benghazi and Libya and the attack on the U.S. consulate there. Of course, the death of four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador to Libya. How do you understand, I guess, what happened and how much al-Qaeda was involved in organizing that attack?
The Benghazi attack is a great illustration of what we mean when we say al-Qaeda, because was there an order from Ayman al-Zawahiri in Pakistan to do this? To my knowledge, no. I would be surprised if that were true. But were there individuals that seemed to be linked to al-Qaeda-related groups in Algeria and some reports of even some jihadists from Egypt? Were they involved in this? And do they have identities more akin to al-Qaeda? Absolutely. So it's this slippery definition of al-Qaeda where it's not exactly Ayman al-Zawahiri, but it's not unrelated individuals either. And they do seem to have seen this as both something they wanted to do for some time and a target of opportunity when things got chaotic. So I do think it was al-Qaeda linked, but that's a little different from saying al-Qaeda was behind the attack.
And is it, are we talking about Ansar al-Asharia?
Yes, although that name is used to refer to lots of different things, and it may have been done by some local fighters who took on that name or took on that label or were a mix of different groups. So that's definitely a possibility, but it's still, at least from what I've seen, rather murky who exactly did this.
But does it also show that our diplomatic corps, perhaps even other countries' diplomatic corps, are vulnerable?
Oh, of course. And this is something that I want to, you know, something we should remember about Ambassador Stevens, and so admirable, is he knew this. He knew that by going into Benghazi, he was going into a place that was quite dangerous. And this is something that, since 9/11, ironically, we've actually been wanting our diplomatic corps to do more of, which is to leave the embassies, to leave the safe capital areas where there's a heavy security and Western presence, and go to more remote parts of the country and interact with the people and gather information and represent the United States. But when we say we want that, we're also saying these individuals will take on more risk. You simply can't have one without the other. And something that, when I was on the various 9/11 investigations, we were trying to encourage was an attitude in the State Department and elsewhere of more risk-taking. And unfortunately, I think one of the fallouts from the Benghazi operation, Benghazi tragedy, is that we're going to see a State Department and U.S. officials that are more buttoned up in their embassies and less able to interact with local populations.
More or taller walls, more barbed wire, more protection in vehicles, things like that.
That's right. It will be a little island that will be in some ways disconnected from the country they're in.
Let me see what Ndungo from Princeton has to say. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome.
I was listening to the your guest, and I think that the point I'm trying to want to make is that one fundamental thing that many experts are missing about al-Qaeda is it's not an organization. Yes, there was a primary organization created by Osama bin Laden and Anwar al-Zawahiri and all of those people in Afghanistan. But al-Qaeda has become what you call a spirit.
It's
not a traditional organization. It's a spirit. So anyone, anywhere can create something and call it al-Qaeda, but they may never have a connection with al-Zawahiri or any other al-Qaeda cell. But because al-Qaeda has already a name, and the same problem that al-Qaeda was created for their safety, frustration of young Muslims, that's really what is going on. And it's not, you cannot fight al-Qaeda by looking for an organization. You know, you have to look at the issues that are the reason why these young people are attracted by these crazy ideas, you know, radical ideas, and try to address those issues locally, or maybe globally, if it's possible.
Well, Ndungo, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Daniel Byman a chance to respond to that, saying that al-Qaeda is more spirit than it is organization.
I think it's both. We do have an organization that is linked to Zawahiri that does have a structure that tries to make local causes more dangerous. And in many ways, that's the biggest part of the problem, which is if you have lots of angry people who are not organized, who don't know what to do, then the danger they represent is considerably diminished.
However, what the caller points out to me is very important, which is, are these organizations able to tap into local sentiment? And that means they can get recruits, they can get funds, they're able to operate more freely. And so part of it is fighting the organization, but part of it is going after the broader ideology and the broader spirit, if you will, that is impelling individuals to join up with these. So to me, it's not one versus the other, it's really both.
And where is Zawahiri?
Well, I don't know, but the conventional wisdom is that he's in a remote part of Pakistan. But as we saw with bin Laden being in a kind of minor city in Pakistan, the conventional wisdom in bin Laden's case was wrong, that he was hiding out in remote areas was what people kept repeating to each other. So I could see people being wrong about Zawahiri, so I will simply say I don't know rather than kind of assume one answer or another.
Well, I appreciate that. One final question, and I think I ran across you saying this, that Zawahiri actually dislikes Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. Did I read that right?
That's absolutely correct. The Brotherhood has, in the last 25, 30 years or so, well before Mubarak fell, had given up violence and had accepted that it would participate in politics in Egypt, even under a fairly corrupt and brutal system. And these concessions for Zawahiri were intolerable. And it's one thing if, you know, Christians or secularists are criticizing the use of violence because he doesn't take those people seriously. They're infidels who you just can't trust anyway. But when people who also purport to be Islamists, people who you're competing for recruits and for fundraising, they're the ones who are saying you shouldn't use violence. That's a direct threat. So that drove Zawahiri crazy, and he even managed to write a fairly long book attacking the Muslim Brotherhood while on the run. So this organization is something that, in the past at least, he saw as way too willing to compromise, and he was disgusted by its rejection of violence.
Well, Daniel Bimon, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Let me pick your brain about Al-Qaeda.
It's been my pleasure.
Thanks very much. And again, Daniel Bimon, our guest. To learn more about Radio Times, including information about Facebook, Twitter, email, the archives, podcasts, satellite radio, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times coming up right after a very short break.